In addition to Western concern about Iran's nuclear program, the West should also be concerned about Iran's terror program. From its start in 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has had a principled position about terror. Namely, it uses terror whenever it can get away without having to pay much of a price. The main use of terror by the Islamic Republic has been at home. In 1988, in the space of a few weeks, according to the man who was at the time Ayatollah Khomeini's designated successor, the Islamic Republic killed 10,000 people extrajudicially, shooting prisoners mostly. After the victory of reformers at the election poll in 1997, the intelligence services went on a campaign of murdering intellectuals and reporters, what's referred to in Iran as the serial murders. And also, the judiciary launched a secret campaign of imprisoning students and reporters without recourse to law. Today, the principal terror victims inside Iran are trade union activists. The Independent Union of Bus Drivers has been in Tehran has been particularly targeted, as have teachers who have struck repeatedly across the country. Iran's terror campaign has also been felt in the West whenever Iran felt it could get away with this. In the early 1990s, under President Rafsanjani, often said to be a moderate, Iran was particularly active in killing dissidents across Europe. Mr. Aliyar reminded us about the murder of Kurdish leaders in Berlin and Vienna, but there were also murders of prominent Iranian dissidents in Geneva and Paris by people directly connected to the regime. There were also bomb campaigns all across Paris to press France to change its foreign policy. Those bomb campaigns, by the way, were sufficiently serious that France, besides deploying military units in Paris, went so far as to impose visa requirements on all visitors from outside the European Union to France, including Americans. This campaign of murder against Iranian dissidents and this bombing campaign across Europe in the 1990s stopped only when strong German-led action against the Iranian government forced Tehran to reverse course. The United States has also suffered. Dozens of Americans were taken hostage in Lebanon. Ronald Reagan's response was to engage Iran and to provide incentives, selling arms to Iran in the middle of its war with Iraq. Iran's response was to release some hostages and to take more. The hostages were freed and the hostage taking stopped only when George Bush became president in 1989 and took instead a strong stance against Iran's actions. At present, Iran's main use of terror is in Iraq and Israel. In Iraq, Iran's actions are well described by the American military when they say that Iran bets on every horse in the race. That is, Iran provides arms for every group which is fighting against the Americans and against the Iraqi government. Most of these arms go to the most radical elements of the Jaish al-Mahdi. These are the special groups of the Jaish al-Mahdi, groups that are not under the control of Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Jaish al-Mahdi, and who have been responsible for the campaign of random slaughter of Sunnis that has killed many tens of thousands. But Iran also arms al-Qaeda in Iraq. And while those arms have been responsible for the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of American soldiers, the great majority of the victims of the Iranian-sponsored terrorism in Iraq are Iraqis. At least 50 Iraqis have died for each American who's been killed. Then we come to Israel. Many at this conference have called attention to Ahmadinejad's hate speech against Israel. I would add that words matter less than actions. Iran could ignore the hate speech as it ignores the hateful speech from Syria. But the real problem is that Iran spends more than $200 million each year providing arms, training, and support for those who are fighting in the field to wipe out Israel, who kill Israelis when they can, and who have launched thousands of rockets against Israel. Hamas is clear that its main financial and military support comes from Iran, and that its program is to eliminate the state of Israel, and that Hamas is at war with Israel. Hezbollah is less clear about its objectives, but Hezbollah refused to stop making war on Israel even after Israel withdrew from every square centimeter of Lebanese territory, as the UN Security Council verified. Now, what is the ideology which guides the use of terror? We have heard much about the religious aspects of the Islamic Republic's ideology. And it is true that the Islamic Republic supports extreme religious views, like nonsense about the 12th Imam and medieval views about women. But I would add to this an important political aspect of the ideology of the Islamic Republic. For indeed, it is an Islamic revolution in the full sense of the term revolution. In fact, what the Islamic Republic is doing has little to do with traditional Islam. Perhaps two, of the Ayatollahs in Iran support the Islamic Republic. The rest reject it. The Islamic Republic's leaders regularly accuse prominent Ayatollahs of practicing, quote, American Islam, end quote, and arrest them. The most prominent religious leader in Iran has been under house arrest for 20 years. And he bitterly criticizes the Islamic Republic on every occasion he gets. The Islamic Republic has substituted folk superstitions, like the nonsense about the 12th Imam, which for centuries has been denounced by the Ayatollahs as anti-Islamic heresy. And some of the sharpest criticisms of this kind of nonsense today come from prominent religious leaders. To be blunt, the Islamic Republic makes up its Islam. It is an ideology that in many ways is like that of Mr. Hitler. It is made up anew. It does not derive from ancient texts. And that is why the great majority of believers and of clerics in Iran reject this vision of Islam and support instead apolitical versions like that of Ayatollah Sistani, the religious leader in Iraq. The Islamic Republic's ideology has much to do with the anti-Western ideologies of the 20th century, like communism or fascism. Iran has had a long revolutionary tradition. In 1953, Iran had one of the largest non-ruling communist parties in the world. And after Mossadegh's overthrow, those people went on to be the high school teachers of Iran. The intellectual life of Iran in the 1960s and 70s was dominated by Marxism. Khomeini rose to political prominence by marrying Marxism and religious extremism, replacing the proletariat with the Mustasafin, the Quranic term for the oppressed of the earth, and replacing imperialism with infidels. Khomeini was very explicit that his regime need not follow Islam. In a famous order, he said that if necessary for the expediency of the regime, any principle of Islam, without exception, could be overridden. And he established a body in the Iranian constitution called the Expediency Council, which has the obligation of overruling religious principles in the name of the expediency of the regime. Khomeini said bluntly that his agenda was seizing power, not advancing Islam. And I would argue that the anti-Israeli agenda of this regime is guided at least as much by its hatred of the West as by the primitive anti-Semitism that it taps into. Let me close by just saying that the revolutionary and religious agendas reinforce each other and are both remarkably ambitious. The leaders of the Islamic Republic really and sincerely believe that they can defeat the West. As they frequently say, they destroyed one superpower, for that is their reading of what happened to the Soviet Union. They say it was destroyed by the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and they think they can destroy another. They see themselves as the leader of the world's 1.4 billion Muslims, and they see themselves as enjoying the support of the oppressed of the earth, which is why they put so much effort, including perhaps $1 billion, into their alliance with Mr. Chavez and his friends in Latin America. Ahmadinejad, as usual, is more blunt in expressing this. In the last week, he has explained that, quote, the countdown to the disintegration of the corrupt powers of the West has begun, end quote. And he has given several major addresses in the last month on the theme that Iran is the world's most powerful country. When UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was leaving office, he did a goodbye tour of the world. He stopped in Tehran and saw Ahmadinejad. As the New York Times described the meeting, Ahmadinejad complained that the United Nations too much reflected the world of 1945. And he went on to say, Britain and America may have won the last world war, but we intend to win the next one. Kofi Annan did not even know there was going to be a next world war, and he certainly did not know that Iran expected to win it. We should understand the extent of these people's ambition. And while we may think that it is absolutely impossible for them to achieve that vision, let me assure you, they will try.
What a blunt picture, I have to say, to even think that Iran could win the next world war. Horrifying.